From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how to think like a serial killer. We talk with John Douglas, former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He pioneered techniques to lure a killer to capture and to track down a killer based on the so-called signature the killer leaves at the site of his crimes. Douglas is the author of the new bestseller Mindhunter. Also, we meet Irish artist Corbin Walker in the new film Frankie Starlight. He makes his acting debut as a dwarf who has written a memoir about his childhood. The film was produced by Noel Pearson, who also produced My Left Foot. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The first elements of the NATO peacekeeping force have begun arriving in Bosnia and Croatia to pave the way for the main contingent of troops to follow. The enabling force, as it's called, will include about 1,400 American soldiers.
This force will prepare the way for a large NATO peace implementation force after the Dayton Agreement is signed in Paris on December the 14th. Before providing the details of that deployment, I want to emphasize again that U.S. troops are going to Bosnia to enforce a peace, not to fight a war.
Defense Secretary William Perry speaking to reporters at the Pentagon this afternoon. The Senate is expected to vote by midweek on a resolution of support for the peacekeeping effort, but GOP leaders are including language to tightly define the U.S. role in the mission. The Supreme Court has rejected a state's attempt to deny Medicaid-funded abortions to women who get pregnant by rape or incest. The justices upheld a lower court's ruling in the case. Colorado's attorney general says the decision could force his state to drop out of the Medicaid system. Since 1976, Congress has limited the Medicaid money available for poor women seeking abortions. The restrictions were loosened last year to allow abortions for women victimized by rape or incest, even if their pregnancies were not life-threatening. Colorado had argued that its more restrictive law should take precedence over the federal guidelines, but the Supreme Court disagreed. U.S. Middle East envoy Dennis Ross was in Jerusalem today trying to restart the stalled peace talks between Israel and Syria. NPR's Eric Weiner reports from Jerusalem.
This is the U.S.'s first attempt at reviving the stalled peace talks since the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin 1 month ago. Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres has promised to continue the talks begun by his slain predecessor. Peres has said he's willing to talk to any Syrian official, anytime, anywhere. But the main obstacle to a peace agreement between Israel and Syria remains the same, the Golan Heights. Syria is insisting on a complete Israeli withdrawal, but Israel wants to maintain early warning defense systems in the region. After meeting with Israeli officials, U.S. Envoy Ross is expected to travel to Damascus later today, where he'll meet with Syrian President Hafez Assad. This is Eric Weiner in Jerusalem.
A man armed with what turned out to be a fake pistol took a second-grade class of children and their teacher hostage at a school in suburban Paris today. But after a two-hour siege, the man freed the hostages and surrendered to police. One official at the scene said the man had acted out of a fit of depression. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 37 points at 5,123.98 in heavy trading. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 14 points. This is NPR News. With the next federal budget deadline less than 2 weeks away now, Senate Democratic leader Tom Daschle says congressional Republicans must be willing to compromise if an agreement is to be reached. Daschle says Democrats have accepted the GOP's 7-year schedule for balancing the budget, so Republicans must agree to the Democrats' goal of limiting spending cuts in areas such as education and the environment. GOP leaders counter that it's time for the president to spell out his specific spending requests. The chairman of General Motors Corporation announced today that after more than 3 years in office, he's stepping down. Current chief executive officer Jack Smith will be taking over the chairman's duties. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
John Smale, the former head of Procter & Gamble, became GM chairman in 1992 when he successfully led a revolt of outside directors, upset with then-chairman Robert Stempel. Smale, who had no experience in the car business other than his years as a member of the GM board, oversaw management efforts to cut costs and return the company to profitability. In a statement, Smale said that the automaker is now back on track, and Jack Smith now becomes both chairman and CEO. Last year, GM's profits topped $5 billion. More importantly, the company has vastly improved the efficiency of its core North American automotive operations. Smale's resignation as chairman is effective January 1st. He will retain his seat on the GM board of directors. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A medical laboratory in Milwaukee has pleaded no contest to reckless homicide charges as part of a plea bargain agreement for misreading the pap smears of two women who later died of cervical cancer. Sentencing has been set for February. The husband of one of the victims said his wife would have been disappointed to see a plea bargain in the criminal case. ChemBio Corporation has already agreed to a $10 million civil settlement for the families of the two women. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Serial killers and serial rapists tend to be the most bewildering, personally disturbing, and most difficult to catch of all violent criminals, according to my guest John Douglas. He's the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He retired from the FBI in June and now has a new bestseller about his work called Mindhunter. Douglas was the model for the FBI agent Jack Crawford in the novel and film Silence of the Lambs. Douglas worked on such cases as the Atlanta child murders, the Tylenol murders, and the Son of Sam. He's interviewed over 150 convicted killers, including Charles Manson, Richard Speck, and Gary Heidnik. By profiling convicted serial killers, he learned that they often leave clues at the scene of the crime that reflect their personalities. Douglas used this information to develop a new approach to tracking down serial killers. He looks for what he describes as the killer's signature.
A signature is that unique aspect about the crime, really something that you should look at when you link cases together. For example, I've testified in cases where the signature was posing. After the killer killed his victims, he would pose the victims in various positions. In another case, I was involved with the common denominator, the signature, was torture. He would torture his victims. Even though the torturing was different in each one of the cases, the common thread was torture. So I would testify, not that the defendant sitting over there is responsible, but for whoever committed these crimes perpetrated all of these crimes because the common thread was torture, posing, or whatever.
Now, you developed your technique for profiling serial killers and tracking them down by interviewing serial killers and serial rapists in California prisons and studying them, getting to know them. Let's look at one of the people who you interviewed and some of the things you learned by talking with him that seemed to be fairly typical of other serial killers as well. Mm-hmm. I was thinking we could look at Ed Kemper.
Okay.
And now, who is he?
Ed Kemper was extremely bright, 145 IQ. He was 6'9". He weighed 300 pounds. When he was 14 years old, he killed his grandparents and called his mom up and told mom, hey, guess what? I killed grandma and grandpa, and I won't be going back next summer visiting them. And so they arrested, of course, Ed Kemper, but they put him in a mental institution, and then they released him at about 18 to 19 years of age. They put him back into society, and I sarcastically will say they cured him. Well, they didn't cure him. He was the victim of a severe amount of child abuse and neglect at the hands of his mother, so they put him back in the custody of his mother. And he was what I would call asexual, asocial. He would have wanted to date, and his mother, who worked at a university, said, hey, listen, you're nothing but a bum. No matter what you do or grew up to be, you'll never be able to date these girls. So in his mind, he said, well, I'm gonna show her. So he would pick up hitchhikers around the campus. He had a university sticker on his car, so the girls, these unsuspecting hitchhikers, felt safe. He would get either one or two girls in the car. It didn't make any difference because he already rigged the door handle when they got into the vehicle. They were unable to open the door once they realized that they were going not in the place where they wanted to go. He then took them out, would kill them, would decapitate them, cut their hands off to delay identification, but then would take the heads back to his house, bury the heads outside of his mother's window, and you know, just would fantasize and about at times even having sex with these girls, although he had no sex with them, but really was trying to get back at and was getting back at mom. The case ended finally after killing seven co-eds. He killed his mother, decapitated her, and put her head on a kitchen table, and basically was kind of chewing her out for the ill treatment that he received throughout his childhood. He then fled, was arrested in Colorado. I think what I learned from an individual like this, it just kind of reinforced the fact that most of the offenders who I interviewed have all come from these dysfunctional families, almost without exception. This is not to say if you come from a dysfunctional family, you're going to grow up to be a violent offender, but of the violent offenders who I've interviewed, they've all come from this particular background.
No, I think you also found out that when this guy was young, he'd torture animals.
Right, and that's what you come in. We call the homicidal triangle, which includes animal cruelty, arson, and enuresis, which is bedwetting. And the bedwetting continues up to 8, 10, 12 years of age. The animal cruelty begins right around kindergarten, 6, 7, 8 years of age. And arson usually starts at about that time. So when you're a parent or if you're a school teacher and you see these characteristics, the odds are very, very high that that this person is going to grow up to be a violent offender. In fact, I've always said that school teachers are probably some of your best profilers because they see these things, these traits, these characteristics very, very early on.
I guess it doesn't shock me that a serial killer would have tortured animals when he was young or started fires when he was young. The bedwetting, I don't really understand.
The bedwetting has to do more of an emotional problem and not a physiological problem with them. And it's from the abuse that they're receiving at the hands of the parents. And so it's really it's an emotional element.
Now, what about Ed Kemper's sex fantasies? Because you say that there's often a connection between somebody's sex fantasies and mm-hmm. their signature when they become a serial killer.
His sex fantasy was really mutilation, decapitation. When he was locked in the cellar of his home, he couldn't live with the rest of the family. He would fantasize by cutting off the heads of his sister's dolls, beheading them. And at times he played with his sister. His sister would participate in, as if he was in the electric chair and she was going to now, you know, kill him, turn on the switch. But he had many morbid fantasies to include this mutilation was the big thing with him. And so sex was not a driving element. Again, it was manipulation and domination and control, again, of the victims. It gave him this power. And I really don't believe either that had he come from a normal, loving, nurturing family that he would have grown up to be this serial killer. It all goes back to early childhood and particularly the mother. The mother plays the most influential part in the development.
But, you know, you've pointed out that the person who the serial killer is most angry at, the abusive parent, for instance, isn't the person who they attack.
No, it's kind of interesting. Rather than strike out at the person that they really despise, they go out on the hunt. And sometimes the person, it starts with the mother, but then now they're in a situation where they're married or have a girlfriend. There's a conflict in that relationship. But rather than go after them, they go out on the hunt looking for a victim, one who they can let out their anger and hostility towards. But then what they do is they take some type of memento, a trophy. It could be a piece of jewelry or a piece of clothing. And like the cat who comes back and drops the mouse on the doorstep, they go back to the wife, to the mother, girlfriend, and they present them with this piece of jewelry. And it's just kind of like a little game they're playing, but they usually want this significant woman in their life to wear this so that they can fantasize and relive the crime over and over in their mind.
As I mentioned, you learned a lot by studying serial killers, interviewing them in depth in prison. What's it like for you, what was it like for you to go into prison and do a personality profile of somebody who, you know, murdered or decapitated a bunch of people? Yeah. I mean, it's not like the kind of interviewing I do.
No, and it takes its toll on you. And many of the people that work for me had difficulty doing this. And the thing you have to do when you do the interview is you have to do the research. You have to go in there armed with with materials regarding the crime. You must look at the crime scene photographs. You must look, if it's a rapist, look at that rapist's style, that verbal, the sexual, the physical assault that he inflicted on this victim. So you must listen. You do the interview, you listen to them, and then after 4 or 5 hours, then you got to go after them and then say, look, I know you're BSing me here. You're trying to pull the wool over my eyes. I don't really care about, you know, that you killed these victims. I do really care, but I can't let him know this. And I'll say, what I'm interested in is how you were able to elude the police for so long. And then I may start telling the killer, if it's a killer I'm talking to, things about himself. For example, I'll say, I know there was a precipitating event leading up to these crimes that pushed you over the top. And I knew there were certain things, you know, going on in your life that people aren't aware of. But let me tell you about yourself, and then I'll go in and I'll start analyzing the crime. And I may say, in this one case that I talk about, a guy named Charlie Davis, I said, Charlie, I said, I know you didn't like this particular kill. And so how do you know that? He says, because after you killed her, you turned her over, you pushed her away from you, and you covered her body up. And I said, what is it, Charlie? What didn't you like about that? And he looks at me, and he got all red, all flushed, and he said, well, when I was, after I raped her, and I knew I had to kill her, she started to beg for life, and she told me that her husband was sick, and she had psychological problems, emotional problems of various types. I felt something towards this victim that I did not want to kill her. So that's why I turned her over, and in fact, I strangled her from the back. I didn't want to look in her eyes. But then I said, now you took something from her, Charlie, didn't you? And I don't ask the question, did you take something, Charlie? I said, I'm very positive because I know the personality. I said, you took something, didn't you? And then what happens is he went into this trance-like state, and he said, I looked in her purse, and in her purse I found a photograph, and the photograph was a picture of her husband and her dog sitting before a Christmas tree. And then I said, you did something with that photograph, didn't you, Charlie? What was it? And he kind of looked, I have him back at the scene now. I said, you went to the gravesite, didn't you, Charlie? And he looks at me and he says, yes. What did you do? And he said, I know he's not lying to me because I could just see the verbals and I could just see his nonverbal communication and he's flushed. He said, I put that photograph at that grave. I buried it just a few inches below the soil. So you really learn. But to do what I do, you have to walk in the shoes of the killer, walk in the shoes of the victim. But it takes an emotional toll. It took an emotional toll on me. And as a result of the toll it took on me, it affected my family, my children.
Yeah, I want to get to that emotional toll a little bit later. Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk more about your work with the FBI. My guest is John Douglas. He's the author of the new book, co-author of the new book, Mindhunter. And he's a pioneer of criminal personality profiling within the FBI, where he specialized in tracking down serial killers. He recently retired from the FBI. This is Fresh Air. Back with John Douglas, co-author of the book Mindhunter, about his career in the FBI, profiling and tracking down serial killers. You've interviewed so many serial killers. Have you found that they ever have any remorse or any sense of what it is they've actually done?
No, they'll fake it, and I'll go along with it. You'll see tears streaming down their face, but the tears are for themselves, that their life is ruined. They could care less about the victims and the families, the lives that they've ruined, but they cry for themselves, and they'll cry post arrest, or they'll cry when you interview them in jail. But there's nothing. There's In fact, if you would polygraph them after the crime, that's why they're very difficult to show deception, because they feel the crimes they committed are justified. So there's nothing there.
Now, would you call a typical serial killer insane?
No. A typical serial killer has a character disorder. He knows right from wrong. I mean, he's not normal, but he's not insane. He's in touch with reality. But usually, again, it's after they've been briefed by the defense attorneys, where they'll come up with defenses such as irresistible impulse as one. And what that is, to give you an example, is if you are standing on a street corner, that the subject is across the street from you, his urges are so strong that he kind of even blacks out, that he must, if his thing is rape or abduction, he will go through with the rape and go through with the crime, follow it up. But I've never seen a case where there's been a woman on a street corner and a police officer on the other corner, and where the subject, through his irresistible impulse, could not control himself, could not contain himself, where he said, well, I better not do anything with this victim. It's a baloney. It's as far as a defense, this irresistible impulse. And so they come up with these defenses, is my point, after they've talked with the defense attorney, and they'll use that as a defense, or post-Vietnam syndrome, when they didn't go to Vietnam, use a Twinkie defense, or hypoglycemia, multiple personality, like Bianchi, the Hillside Strangler, tried to use. And it's all a bunch of baloney. These people have a character disorder. They're psychopaths.
You describe serial killers as psychopaths. What does that mean to you? And I've heard sociopath used a lot.
Yeah, it's basically the same thing. Sociopath or antisocial behavior. It's basically the same person who has this character disorder, does not have a conscience at all, and will show no remorse for their crimes. If you could compare them to an animal, or I would compare them to a chameleon. They can blend into their environment, be very nice, very, very charming. They can get some unsuspecting victim, out of a bar at night, or get a child out of a shopping center in broad daylight, and just scoop that child away from his parents.
One of the things you did at the FBI was to create a style of interviewing serial killers or accused mm-hmm. serial killers. And tell the Bloody Rock story.
Oh, this was in Adairsville, Georgia, and where a young girl, Marie Stoner, was abducted after being dropped off on a school bus in front of her home. They found her body about 10, 11 miles away in a Lover's Lane area. Mary Stoner was only 14 years of age at the time. She would be killed by the use of a rock, about a 40-45 pound rock that was picked up by the offender and carried over to her while she was on the ground still, because he attempted to strangle her with his hands. He didn't have the strength enough to do it. So she was unconscious. So he drops this rock on her head several times, and killing Mary Stoner. So I did a profile of the offender, that this would be someone I felt that he would be in his mid to late 20s. There's a degree of sophistication. He's fairly organized. He was able to lure her into his car, because it would take a car to drive her to this particular location. He'll be in a menial occupation and probably even maybe working in that area during the last week or several weeks. You're going to find that he's had problems most very, very recently with a woman, could be married, separated, whatever. But then rather than strike out at her, he's going to go on the hunt and look for a potential victim of opportunity. But I said, this particular girl, it was very outgoing, low-risk victim, but every day she'd come home wearing this short skirt. So here you had an offender that was in the area looking at her, but his totally misinterpreting what he sees. He actually thinks that this girl is going to go willingly with him, have sex, and then go home to his house. And I said, he did not feel good about this homicide. I said, what do you mean by that? And I said, well, because check check your records. I bet he strangled this girl from the back with her back turned to him. And they came back later and they said, yes, you're right. How do you know that? I said, because when he was raping this girl in the car, he did not expect what would happen next. And that's when you have to walk in the shoes of the victim. And what when you walk in her shoes, and what I attempted to do and try to feel was that she was under an extreme amount of pain. She was crying. She was sobbing. Please take me home. I'll do anything. But he knew now he lost control of the situation, so he had to kill her. And so then he picks up this rock and drops this rock on her head several times. So John, they said, you interviewed a guy. We've interviewed a guy now, but you're describing him to a T. We just released him. We have him scheduled for the polygraph today. I said, hey, go ahead, but you're going to get no deception or inconclusive. They call me back up. And they say, John, you're right. We got inconclusive at best, and it appears to be no deception. But he fits this profile. I said, okay, let's do a nighttime interview, and we're going to bring the rock, introduce the rock into the interview environment. I want a nighttime interview because I want him, on one hand, to feel comfortable in this environment, but I want to create stress, and the stress will be the murder weapon. If, in fact, he is the killer, he will respond to that murder weapon. But place the murder weapon on a 45-degree angle off in the corner of the room and bring him in, just for a routine type of questioning again.
So when you put the rock in the room, the bloody rock that was the murder weapon, how did the serial killer respond to it? What clues did he give you that he was actually the killer?
Okay, what happened was, different from the prior interviews, they said he was very cocky, very assured of himself. He goes into the room, he sits down, he looks over, and he sees this rock. Right away, they can see his respiration increases. He's beginning to, his heart, they're looking at his artery, carotid artery in his throat. They could see it beating. They could see he's perspiring. He's crossing his arms, crossing his legs. And he's really getting tense from looking at this particular, it's the murder weapon.
And he can't take his eyes off of it?
Can't take his eyes off of it. And so so the other thing you have to do to get him to confess, because he killed a 14-year-old girl and he's 27, 28 at the time, is you have to provide a face-saving scenario. It's a horrible thing to do when you hear what you have to say, but what you have to say to get the confession is that the girl, in essence, she was the seducer, that she kind of put him up to this, but you, Mr. Killer, you've lost control. You lost control of the situation, and through fear, you killed her, almost like an accident type of thing. And so they did that. They took that advice, and lo and behold, he confesses to that particular rape murder, but also to a rape 3 years earlier it was Rome, Georgia. So that was one of the first experiments that I did. And over the years, I've learned to try to find something at the crime scene, something that only the killer or whatever the crime may be would react to that particular stressor.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. His new memoir is called Mindhunter. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with John Douglas, former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. And we meet Irish artist Corbin Walker. He stars in the new film Frankie Starlight, playing Frankie, a dwarf who has written a memoir about his unusual childhood. The film also stars Gabriel Byrne and Matt Dillon. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Back with John Douglas, the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. He retired from the FBI in June and now has a best-selling memoir called Mindhunter. He pioneered a type of criminal personality profiling based on what he's learned interviewing over 150 convicted killers. In his book, and in the first part of our interview, he explained some of the techniques he developed for tracking down serial killers and sex criminals. Are you giving away in your book, and of course in this interview, things that will help serial killers evade the cops?
No, that's a good question, because behavior reflects personality, I keep saying in that book. And I, myself, if I committed a crime, and I know all the tricks, I've taught the tricks, I would not be able to defend myself. If I was involved in a situation like that with The Rock, and they brought this in, or how about IRS, you know, brings you in, and if you fudged on your IRS record keeping, and they just bring the stuff in and place it off to the side, where you see this, the difference is that, and even these individuals, the psychopaths who have no conscience, everyone has a rock, and that's what we mean by that, is that you just have to find out what buttons you have to push and what the stressors are. But they can read this. I mean, they can read that, well, Douglas says that the killers go back to the gravesite, and I do go back to the graves. I want to go back there, so I'm not going to do that. Well, no, he's going to want to do that. He's going to be more careful. He's going to look around, and we have to be more careful as a law enforcement agencies, you know, and secrete ourselves better, hide better in that particular area so that the killer doesn't see us, but they'll go back. They always do.
Part of your technique is empathy, to put yourself in the shoes mm-hmm. of the victim and the killer. What kind of number does that play on you after you do that a whole lot?
Well, it wears you down, but to be good, and probably that's why I was the main guy in doing this in the bureau and I guess anywhere in the country now, is that you have to be able to do that. To get in the shoes, you have to just have laughed with these guys, and I dress down when I do the interviews. If you would go by and see and hear me do the interview of a killer, you would probably have difficulty knowing who was the killer, because I do a pretty good job of it.
We might think it was you?
Yeah, well, you think it was me. We'd have a difficult time, because I would not be, you know, I'm not going to be that stiff. I'm going to be joking and laughing about the kills and this and that, but I'm looking for golden nuggets. I have to do this to get something that I can apply to an ongoing case. But then what's even more so is the victims, because I get very close to the families, and I empathize with the families and with the victim, and I try to imagine what the victim was hearing and was seeing and was feeling, that whole thing right up to her death. Because I have tapes of women and children who are in the process of dying, and there's this regression of calling back to their mommies, and I mean it's terrible, but it takes its toll, and it has taken the toll on the people who work for me in my unit before I left, and many of them can only last three to five years. I stayed in this, I was doing that alone for nearly 20 years.
In 1983, when you were, I think it was 38, you got viral encephalitis, which raised your temperature about 107. You were in a coma. It came very close to killing you. When you were going into the coma, you imagined that all the killers who you had interviewed and helped track down over the years were taking the revenge on you and torturing you. Mm. It really made me think about what your own fantasy life must be like, having lived through hearing all these other really sick fantasies yeah. told to you.
Well, when you say my fantasy, what do you mean my fantasy?
Nightmares.
Oh, nightmares.
I don't mean like the things that you wish you could do, but when your mind is left free at night and it just kind yeah. of roams around into the dark corners.
Well, it's gotten better, but you know, nowadays and over the last, you know, say even 10 years, but at that particular time, it was pretty bad. It was pretty hard on me, and I was working so many cases, 150 cases, and dealing with all these crazy people and again, it was taking its toll on me because I was, again, walking in the shoes and trying to help the victims, the families of the victims. So basically what happened to me is I broke down. I broke down physically. I was probably jogging too much, drinking too much to cope with the stress of it. I was one-dimensional. I was only interested in work. Family was secondary. There was no religion, no socializing. So when I went out on the Green River murder case, I mean, I just broke down. So when and had that high temperature you talked about and nearly died. I was paralyzed when I came out of a coma after a week. But while in that coma, I was aware of the pain that I was receiving, and that was them putting me on a life support system and putting tubes in every part of me. And I thought I was in hell. I really thought that all these crazies now were torturing me, and I'm going to die here. And it wasn't until a nurse began talking to me, that she didn't know I could hear her, that I just calmed down. She said, "John, you're very sick. You're in a hospital, and we're going to try to make you better." That I calmed down, but I'd be lying to you if I told you that it does not. I don't think about cases, or if I'm out with my children in a park, that I'm looking at an area in the park and saying, "Gee, this looks like a place where I've had a case before, where there's a disposal, someone disposed of a body," or if I go out in a shopping mall with my two of my daughters, I'll point out potential people there that are up to no good. I'll point them out and say, "Hey, Lauren, take a look at that guy over there. See how he's looking at those children in that video arcade? He's looking at those children as if, they're adult women. They're Raquel Welch." I said, "Let's just follow him, Lauren. Let's just see what he does." So I'll get my daughter, and we'll be following the guy, and the person will be following a child, almost like waiting for this opportunity. And I said, "Now, this is not the kind of guy that's going to drag this child out of the store, Lauren, but this is the type of individual, when you're out selling candy for your church or the Girl Scouts, and you knock on a door, and he just happens to be the living at that house, and he looks out, and I'm not with you as a parent. You're alone. You have now just crossed this path, and you can now become a victim of opportunity."
Gee, did you worry about turning your daughter into somebody who was completely paranoid, who'd go into the playground and just scout out potential perverts?
I'd rather have her a little paranoid than to be so carefree and hitchhiking and trusting and naive. They have to know that there's some people out there. There's just some bad people that are going to hurt you.
I wonder if you give advice to people who don't want to become victims. You know, you'll hear one, like, professional consultant will say, if someone ever says, "Get into my car or I'll kill you," even if they say they're going to kill you, don't get into the car, because they're bound to kill you if you do get into the car. Or someone will say, yeah, if someone points a gun on you, run or don't run. Are there any rules to follow, or do you think every criminal is different, every crime is different, and you've just got to do your best to assess the situation?
Right. Which is so different. You have to. Every crime is different. If it's a woman, has to, as a victim, a potential victim, has to make an assessment within seconds. If a scenario is, this would be a good scenario, particularly with the holidays, is the vehicle of choice today is a van. It's a construction type of van, which is insulated in the interior. It's like a room within a room. Inside you have flex cuffs, and they have handcuffs, duct tape. And you are just shopping in a shopping center, and you're walking out to your car. You don't have your keys ready. You're carrying bundles of gifts. You're thinking of tonight's dinner. And you didn't realize, first you're parked way off in the parking lot. It's dark. And you didn't really notice this vehicle is very, very close, parked very close to you. The next thing you do, or you find out, is that as you enter your car, just before you enter your car, the side doors of the van opens up, you're whisked in there, and in a matter of seconds, you've been cuffed or duct taped, and off you go. You have to fight. You have to fight like hell, and as best as you can do in seconds. You're not going to be able to talk your way out of it. Just through deductive reasoning here, you're in his vehicle, so you're going to be able to identify the vehicle in the future. Plus, he probably doesn't have a disguise. You'll be able to pick him out in a lineup. So the chances are, you're not only going to be abducted, you're going to be murdered. So that's one thing. But then, if you're looking at, say, a rapist, there are six different rape typologies. And if someone comes into your house, And you really, you don't know which particular rapist that you're dealing with. Are you dealing with a sadistic rapist who borders on murder? Or are you dealing with we call a power reassurance rapist who wants to make it pleasurable for you, and he talks to you, and he somewhat feels guilty afterwards? But I believe in these classes of defensive tactics. I mean, because if you're going to get away, you got to get away soon, right in the very, very beginning.
Well, I want to thank you so much.
Well, thank you
for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
John Douglas is the former head of the FBI's Serial Crime Unit. His new memoir is called Mindhunter. This is Fresh Air. One of the producers of the film My Left Foot, Noel Pearson, has produced a new movie called Frankie Starlight, featuring Gabriel Byrne and Matt Dillon. Set in Dublin, it's about a dwarf named Frank Bois, who has written a memoir about his unusual childhood. Much of the movie is a flashback of his early years. My guest Corbin Walker stars as the adult Frank. It's a fine performance, and it's the first time he ever acted. Walker is a sculptor who lives in Dublin. He says the first time he saw himself on the screen, it was frightening.
Completely frightening, because, well, first of all, you're like 20 feet high and 30 feet wide on a screen, and you're all made up to look completely different, to look like another person, except it's you, that you yourself under that person. I don't know, the first time I saw it, I wasn't really able to relax at all, because I was constantly watching and constantly criticizing the way I was acting, the way I was working. But by the second time I saw it, I was able to really relax and follow the story a lot more.
There's a 13-year-old actor who plays the younger version of your character. Was it hard for the casting people to find someone who could be the younger you?
I think it was. Yeah, they had a pretty hard time trying to find him, because they were looking at people throughout Ireland and also in England, I think. And then they came across Alan Pentany in a town in called Drogheda, and he was wonderful. He was brilliant just from the very first meeting they had, and he's an amazing kid. I've never met any kid like him before in my life, and he's 13, and he's a sharpness of his own character and his own self-esteem that is very unusual for a person of his age.
No, he, like you, is a dwarf. Have you known many other people of your height over the years, and was this an interesting experience for you?
I haven't known that many people of the same height as me. Every now and again, you run into, one or two. And when I was a child, though, there was an association for small people or for dwarfs in Ireland, but it was very badly underfunded, so it kind of collapsed. And so we didn't really see each other that much afterwards. But working with Alan, or at least being with him for those few months, and also now, again, since we've been meeting each other here and in Ireland, has been really great, because it's really nice to be able to hang out with somebody who knows how you feel and how you get around, and because a lot of other people aren't aware of what it entails to be 4 foot tall or smaller.
What does it entail? What is different?
Well, it entails constantly being smaller. I mean, obviously, it's smaller than everybody else. It's harder to get in and out of places. It's harder to attract people's attention because they don't see you. It's harder to dress yourself because there aren't that many clothes in shops that will fit you. Kind of practical things like that, really.
Now, the character in Frankie Starlight, his height actually seems to set him apart and make him more inward, more reflective. Did that happen to you too, do you think?
Not really, no, because His character was quite different to mine. I mean, I came from a rather large family. There was five children. So there was always a lot of interaction between us and a lot of support from the family. I mean, the family worked together. I mean, I was never made to feel special or different in any way, apart from the fact that I was slightly smaller. I mean, I was brought up, like the rest of the children in my family, to basically just to act your age. So it was, I think, a lot better for me that way. With the character, he's the only child. His mother is not a very forthcoming woman. She warns him all the time of to prepare himself for this alienation, for solitude, to tell him to realize that he might actually be alone for a lot of his life. And so when he finally does come out from being like a hermit, he begins to really live his life for the first time.
So you were never in that predicament of being the hermit and being that set apart?
No, not really. No, not at all, actually. Because I always had great friends. I mean, very good close friends, and a lot of good support from my family as well.
When did you realize that you were different and you weren't going to grow the same way everybody else around you was?
I suppose I first realized it when my younger sister, Kianet, started shooting it by me, and she was growing a lot faster than I was. And that's when I was, I suppose, 5 or 6, and she was like 3 years younger than me.
What was your attitude about that, and did that change over the years?
My attitude at the time was obviously a bit bewildered by it all. I knew from an early age that things were going to be different for me because, you know, I would go to a doctor, an orthopedic doctor, and I would have to wear special shoes, and he made me wear these special shoes so that my legs wouldn't bow, so that my legs would remain practically straight, because that's a big problem with small people is that their weight is top heavy, their top half of their body is heavier than the bottom half of them, so the weight makes their legs bow and makes them kind of walk from on one leg at a time rather than simultaneously. When I was growing up then, I was really trying to act my own age and trying to hang out with the people who were the same age as me and do the same things as they were doing, play the same games. Obviously there were limitations because I couldn't run as fast as they could, you know, things like that. But for the most part, I mean, it was pretty much the same as the other kids.
My guest is Corbin Walker. He stars in the new film Frankie Starlight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Corbin Walker in the new film Frankie Starlight. He plays Frank, a dwarf who has written a memoir about his childhood. This is Walker's acting debut. He's an artist, a sculptor, based in Dublin. Now, you're an artist. I regret I haven't seen any of your work because I don't think you've shown in America yet, but I know you've shown a lot in Ireland. How did you become interested in visual arts?
Well, there's a very strong background of visual arts in my family. And also, I mean, my mother was very heavily involved in it, in art criticism, and my father was an architect. So there was always a heavy kind of awareness of art in my upbringing. Also, I suppose I was really fascinated by it and loved it. I mean, I loved history as well. That was the other major love I had in school. And so when I left school, I knew I kind of wanted to do some form of art. And so I went to applied to get into art college and got in and kind of messed around for a while to find out what I really wanted to do. And then what I wanted to do was sculpture. And I've been doing that more or less ever since. And then occasionally now, more recently, going back to do some painting, but it's mostly sculpture that I do.
I wonder if your sculptures are involved with size and scale at all.
They are, yeah. They're very much involved with size and scale. The work that I do is completely based on my size and my scale in relation to everybody else's.
How? Can you give us? Can you describe one of the pieces that does that?
I suppose I can describe. When I was in college, the big main piece that I did for when I finished college was this chair, which basically was put in somebody that was, say, 6 foot high in a chair and making them sit in the chair the exact same way I would sit in the chair, now in a normal chair, for instance. And for that to happen, I needed to make the chair very, very big so that when they sat back in the chair, they would be, their feet would be dangling over the edge of the seat and not at all reaching the ground, because that's what happens when I sit in what you would call a normal armchair, is that my feet are dangling over the edge, and if I sit here long enough, my feet are going to swell up and they're going to begin to be a bit painful and I'll have to step down off the seat. So that's what I did. I mean, that was a very obvious way of doing it. I mean, the work that I've been doing most recently, which was based a lot on the film that I did, was basically putting people through a kind of film process, a kind of film acting process, which was to make these very minimalist columns, very tall, slender columns that were only 3 or 4 inches wide and 3 or 4 inches deep, but they were 10 feet tall, and one side of them was mirrored. And these columns were spaced individually at about, say, 10 inches apart and running along one side of a room. So when you walked into the room, when the viewer walked into the room, they got this very sharp, animated reflection of themselves walking through the room or being in the room or watching somebody else in the room. And so the piece was really about that, about performing for the work, for something else, which was basically what I was doing during the film. I was working for somebody else.
Has your height ever changed the way you saw art in museums because the paintings were hung too high or sculptures were maybe on a pedestal that was high?
I mean, yeah.
Did it hurt your access to art?
It certainly influenced my access to art and the way I would access other people to art. I suppose particularly in pieces that were that are on plinths or on pedestals, it's quite hard to see them, or to see them without straining your neck. But with paintings, it's pretty much all right because, you know, you need to stand back from paintings and see them with, you know, a bit of depth in front of you. Also, I suppose then with larger three-dimensional works, I'm kind of very enthused by them because in a lot of work you can kind of get in under it and see how it's made from underneath. Or, you know, a lot of people, taller people, I think when they're viewing sculpture, and particularly large sculpture, they don't like to stand back from it because they don't really see how it's put together or how it's holding. And I suppose because I am a sculptor and I would know a little bit more of how things are made and how they're standing, that I always like trying to get in as close as possible to it and see how it's made and see what it's like from underneath, but also to see what it's like from far away.
Now, I want to get back to acting. You tried to act for the first time in your late 20s and really succeeded awfully well at it. Has this opened the door for you to think, well, there's other things I'm going to try that I never dreamed I'd do before?
Well, there's certainly other things in the movies that I'd like to try.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd love to try some more acting and do some more acting, because I think there are wonderful roles for somebody who's 4 foot high that don't necessarily have to be related completely to his height. You know, I mean, he could play, you know, any kind of a role, from, you know, the Law and Order roles to the doctor to a writer to, you know, a musician to an astronaut, you know, any of these kind of roles that are seen in films could be played by somebody like me. So I'd like to do that. I'd love to have an opportunity to do that again. I'd also like to do a period movie, because there's a great story of a Spanish painter, Diego Velázquez, who was a 17th century painter, and he's painted a lot of dwarfs, but the dwarfs were actually courts to the monarchy, to the Spanish monarchy, and they were very influential within the monarchy. So I think that's a wonderful story that could be developed there and made into a movie.
Well, probably everybody's going to pitch the Toulouse-Lautrec story to you, right?
There's also the Toulouse-Lautrec story, yeah, certainly. But also, I mean, just from doing that film, I'd love to, like, even to get behind the camera and start, you know, making films and making them, projecting them on two different levels, you know, on the one screen. Things like that, you know. I mean, there's all sorts of opportunities there that are available, I suppose, to the imagination that can be exploited.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Corbin Walker stars in the movie Frankie Starlight. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Kathy Wolf, and Barbara Bogave. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.